We're going to read about Hale Boggs and his descent and ultimate fate, turning again to Coincidence or Conspiracy by Bernard Fensterwald. Of Hale Boggs, Fensterwald writes, quote, "You have got to do everything on earth to establish the facts one way or the other. And without doing that, why, everything concerned, including every one of us, is doing a grave disservice," unquote. Thus, House Majority Leader Hale Boggs delivered an admonishment of sorts to his Warren Commission colleagues on January 27, 1964. Along with Senator Richard Russell and, to a lesser degree, Senator John Sherman Cooper, Congressman Boggs served as a beacon of skepticism and probity in trying to fend off the FBI and CIA's efforts to, quote, shade, unquote, and indeed manipulate the findings of the Warren Commission. Like Russell, Boggs was very simply a strong doubter. Several years after his death in 1972, a colleague of his wife, Lindy, who was elected to fill her late husband's seat in the Congress, recalled Mrs. Boggs remarking, quote, "Hale felt very, very torn during his work on the commission. He wished he had never been on it and wished he'd never signed it, the Warren Report." Unquote. A former aide to the late House Majority Leader has recently recalled, quote, "Hale always returned to one thing. Hoover lied his eyes out to the commission on Oswald, on Ruby, on their friends, the bullets, the gun, you name it." Unquote. Almost from the beginning, Congressman Boggs had been suspicious over the FBI and CIA's reluctance to provide hard information when the commission's probe turned to certain areas, such as allegations that Oswald may have been an undercover operative of some sort. When the commission sought to disprove the growing suspicion that Oswald had once worked for the FBI, Boggs was outraged that the only proof of denial that the FBI offered was a brief statement of disclaimer by J. Edgar Hoover. It was Hale Boggs who drew an admission from Alan Dulles that the CIA's record of employing someone like Oswald might be so heavily coded that the verification of his service would be almost impossible for outside investigators to establish. I would cite parenthetically the case of CIA and Naval Intelligence operative Gunter Rusbacher, who maintains he was involved with the October surprise. He was deeply involved with the intelligence community. An awful lot of heat comes down on anyone who investigates it, but it would prove his background might very well, just like Oswald's, according to Alan Dulles, prove almost impossible to verify for outsiders. Continuing, Boggs and Dulles had the following exchange. Representative Boggs, "So I will ask you, did you have agents about whom you had no record whatsoever?" Mr. Dulles, "The record might not be on paper, but on paper we would have hieroglyphics that only two people knew what they meant, and nobody outside of the agency would know, and you could say this meant the agent, and someone else could say it meant another agent." Congressman Boggs had been the commission's leading proponent for devoting more investigative resources to probing the connections of Jack Ruby. With an early recognition that, quote, "the most difficult aspect of this is the Ruby aspect," unquote, Boggs had wanted an increased effort made to investigate the accused assassin's murderer. Continuing here, Boggs was perhaps the first person to recognize something which numerous Warren Commission critics would write about in future years: the strange variations and dissimilarities to be found in Lee Harvey Oswald's correspondence during 1960 to 1963. Some critics have advanced a theory that some of Oswald's letters, particularly correspondence to the American Embassy in Moscow and later to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, may have been, quote, planted, unquote, documents written by someone else. In 1975 and 1976, the investigations of the Senate Intelligence Committee and other congressional groups disclosed that such uses of fabricated correspondence had been a recurring tool of the FBI's secret domestic COINTELPRO, or counterintelligence program, as well as other intelligence operations. In any event, Warren Commission member Boggs and Commission General Counsel Lee Rankin had early on discussed such an idea. Mr. Rankin, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, denied he was a member, and also he wrote to them and tried to establish, as one of the letters indicate, a new branch there in New Orleans, the Fair Play for Cuba. Representative Boggs, "That letter has caused me a lot of trouble. It is a much more literate and polished communication than any of his other writing," unquote. And Fensterwald goes on to write, "It is also known Boggs felt that because of the lack of adequate material from the FBI and CIA, the commission members were poorly prepared for the examination of witnesses. According to a former Boggs staffer, the congressman felt that lack of adequate file preparation and the sometimes erratic scheduling of commission sessions served to prevent those same sessions from being adequately substantive. Consequently, Boggs cut down his participation in these sessions as the investigation stretched on through 1964. So Cokie Roberts should perhaps have taken a good look at what her father really had to say about the Warren Commission, and perhaps she might have brought herself to investigate, to at least see the movie. Again, she stated that she would not see the movie because her father had been a member of the Warren Commission. Her father obviously entertained serious doubts and was a dissenting member of the commission. Let's take a look at what happened to Hale Boggs, skipping down in Fensterwald's text. On October 16, 1972, Hale Boggs vanished during a flight in Alaska from Anchorage to Juneau. Despite a 39-day search by the Air Force, Navy, and Coast Guard, no trace of the twin-engine plane on which Boggs was traveling has ever been found. Had he been alive today, Boggs would probably have become Speaker of the House, having held the number two leadership post in Congress at the time of his disappearance. There is no doubt Boggs would have been a singularly important figure in any reopening of the Kennedy case. Well, Hale Boggs went down, too, in a plane. Nobody knows where. Apparently, the Air Force, Navy, and Coast Guard weren't able to find the plane despite a 39-day search. So perhaps, we cannot say for sure, but perhaps Hale Boggs is another one of the mysterious deaths in connection with the... Well, certainly is a mysterious death, perhaps a murder, in connection with the assassination of John Kennedy. And perhaps, again, Cokie Roberts should be a little slow to criticize, and perhaps she would do well to examine her father's work, his life, and his death in connection with the Kennedy assassination. And I would also note that October 16th of 1972 was about 4 months, almost exactly 4 months to the day after the Watergate burglars were apprehended. And again, last week, in a major addendum to the Guns of November Part 3, I noted the very strong connections between the Kennedy assassination and Watergate. That concludes this portion of the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. I'm going to take a very short musical break by way of punctuation, and then we're going to come back and we're going to take a look at a few things that are going on today, specifically some new information vis-a-vis the Los Angeles riots. So a little bit of music, a little more music, and then the rest of tonight's prepared portion. We're going to continue now with our prepared portion, and we're going to turn from the events of yesteryear to the events of today. Specifically, we're going to take a look very quickly at some developments vis-a-vis the investigation of the Los Angeles rioting and attendant pieces of information. One of the things that I discuss in the immediate aftermath of the Los Angeles rioting, and something that I had warned about prior, or when the officers were indicted for beating Rodney King, was that with tensions in the community running as high as they were, if the officers were acquitted, the community would be ripe for an explosion. I also cited the history of elements of the Los Angeles Police Department, such as the criminal conspiracy section, in working with elements of the federal intelligence apparatus to establish provocations, that is to say, terrorist incidents that were set up, set up to provoke a reaction. And in particular, in the late 60s and early 70s, elements of the criminal conspiracy section were involved in a number of different things, including provocations and incidents set up to destroy the Black Panthers, as well as an abortive conspiracy in connection with elements of our national security establishment to blow up the Republican convention in San Diego in 1972. This to serve as a pretext. It would be blamed on militants and anti-war activists. This would serve as a pretext for establishing martial law in the United States. And there were unconfirmed, as far as I know, unconfirmed eyewitness reports broadcast on some of the Pacifica stations in both Los Angeles and the Bay Area of agent provocateur activity. And again, given the history of elements of the LAPD in performing agent provocateur activity, and in light of the curious behavior of the LAPD, which simply fell back and allowed the rioting to proceed, there are some questions to be asked and answered in that particular regard. Recall that Chief Gates himself had warned of the possibility of violence if the officers were acquitted. Despite that, the LAPD reacted in very, very strange fashion. And to the credit of many officers of the LAPD, they have come forward to criticize the behavior of the department in that regard. I would note something that many of you have no doubt taken note of in connection with the investigation of the LAPD's handling of the rioting. The person that has been appointed to investigate that is none other than former CIA Director William Webster, also Director of the FBI. It should be noted that one never becomes Director of Central Intelligence and severs one's connections with the agency. If you get that high in the CIA, you never leave completely. George Bush certainly didn't, and it is a foregone conclusion that Webster, knowing as much as he must know, has never severed his connections with the agency. So the fact that he was picked to investigate the LAPD's handling of the rioting is more than a little interesting and bears investigation. An account of that can be found, among other places, in the Los Angeles Times of Tuesday, May 12th of 1992, a story by Rich Connell, or Connell, C-O-N-N-E-L-L, and Ted Rorlich, R-O-R-L-I-C-H, of the LA Times. It's headlined, Webster to Head Probe of Police Response to Riot. And it is subheaded Law Enforcement. The former FBI director says he will look into, quote, every form of leadership that affected the performance of the LAPD. Not going to read the story. You know, all the major papers carried stories about this. But, again, my fear that maybe agent provocateur had been used to provoke the Los Angeles rioting, thereby polarizing the American political community and perhaps gaining support for reactionary politicians such as Bush. Certainly when there is rioting, race rioting, when that occurs in the country, it does tend to polarize the electorate, and it tends to work in favor of hard-nosed law and order candidates like George Bush. I would also note in passing that William Webster is now working for the law firm of Milbank, Tweed, Hadley, and McCloy. That's the old law firm of John McCloy, U.S. Commissioner, High Commissioner of Germany, who released many notorious war criminals into the service of the Gehlen Organization. He also, as we looked at last week, a key member of the Warren Commission, and was also being tabbed by Richard Nixon to become Watergate's special prosecutor. Another story we took a look at in connection with the Los Angeles rioting concerns a National Guardsman who was arrested in Beverly Hills with weapons, material to make Molotov cocktails, and blinded license plates, or concealed license plates. He showed up for arraignment in his National Guard uniform. A story about that in the Los Angeles Times of Wednesday, June 10th of 1992. It's continued on page A13 in the inside. It begins on the first page. Once again, reading about this particular incident. In Beverly Hills, police officers stopped a car and found that the trunk contained two empty barbecue sauce bottles, a towel that had been torn in half, and a full can of gasoline in a brown paper bag. Next to it was another gasoline can empty. The two young men in the car were wearing T-shirts that read, "Arrest the President," unquote, on the front, and on the other side, quote, "Intelligent Hoodlums," unquote. One was the son of a USC professor who showed up in court wearing his National Guard uniform because he had been activated for riot duty. Both men have pleaded not guilty to illegal possession of an incendiary device. So again, Beverly Hills was a very wealthy part, of course, of Los Angeles. One wonders what these two individuals were doing there. I also find the T-shirt "Arrest the President" and "Intelligent Hoodlums" to be a little interesting. Again, we cannot draw a conclusion from that, but I do think it raises some questions about the possible use of agent provocateur in connection with the Los Angeles rioting. Another story, which may not be significant, but which might be indications of agent provocateur activity past or present. This was carried in the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, May 23rd of 1992. This is an article by Stephen Schwartz of the Chronicle. Its headline, Fort Ord may be link in guns and drugs plot, subheaded L.A. gang probers reportedly trace deal. It reads in part as follows. San Bernardino County Sheriff's deputies have arrested two Barstow men and are seeking a third in an alleged weapons for drugs conspiracy that may have extended from Los Angeles street gangs to military personnel at Fort Ord. CBS News reported yesterday that gang investigators in Los Angeles had traced a guns for drugs deal to the Monterey County base. Skipping down, military supplies found in his house, this is the house of Ed Jordan, military supplies found in his house in Barstow reportedly included grenade and artillery simulators, anti-riot gas grenades, and a gas grenade launcher. Jordan allegedly told authorities that he had attempted to sell the weapons or exchange them for drugs with gang members who he said were attempting to obtain weapons from the base. Well, I do not know whether or not this account is factual, whether they actually were, that is to say, gang members attempting to obtain military weapons, but reports of this, even if they're not true, could serve to polarize the very tense situation in Los Angeles. The Crips and Bloods were reported to have united. There were numerous accounts being circulated by the LAPD that the Crips and Bloods were going to join forces to begin waging war on the Los Angeles Police Department. These are unconfirmed. But reports like this, whether or not it's true, could serve as a justification for increased security in Los Angeles, perhaps the introduction of federal troops or martial law. I would recall in this regard the discussion that I had with Harry Martin 2 weeks ago, and a high-ranking Army officer released orders to him that were issued May 1st of 1992, right after the rioting began. Those orders were marked Garden Plot, and in all probability refer in some way to Operation Garden Plot and Cable Splicer. These were operations put together in which coordinated the military intelligence, the FBI, CIA, and state and local law enforcement to suppress not only the anti-Vietnam War movement, but also elements of the Black Power movement as well. They were put into effect under Richard Nixon. They were very active in California under Ronald Reagan, and two graduates of those operations, Louis Ufrida and Ramon Salcido, both employed at the California Specialized Training Institute in San Luis Obispo, graduated to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, where they, along with Oliver North, put together the Rex 84 Operation Night Train Martial Law Contingency Plans that were revealed as a result of the Iran-Contra scandal. I would also point out that the orders released to Harry Martin by this officer were obviously referring to more than just Garden Plot or anything having to do with the L.A. rioting. They were also being issued to the Strategic Air Command at Offutt Air Force Base, SINCPAC, Naval Commander-in-Chief for the Pacific, the European Command, and the Marines. So it obviously referred to something more than just the L.A. rioting. I mean, what is the Navy or the Strategic Air Command going to have to do with rioting in Los Angeles? But it is a disturbing report, one which is etched in stone at this time. I did not even know that Operation Garden Plot and Cable Splicer were current. Perhaps those plans, which were put into effect very successfully against the anti-war movement and the Black Power movement, perhaps those plans were then put on the shelf to be activated if needed, and perhaps the authorities viewed the Los Angeles rioting as just exactly as a public uprising, so to speak, a conscious political uprising. I would note ominously that the Operation Night Train Rex 84 martial law contingency plans put together by Ufrida and Salcido when they were at the CSTI in California under Reagan, those were based on contingency plans to round up to 20 million black people and put them in concentration camps, detention centers, in the event of an uprising by black militants. A very chilling scenario, and one which we have to ask ourselves perhaps could come into effect, particularly in light of the possibility of further uprisings or further disturbances either in Los Angeles or elsewhere. And one of the questions we have to ask ourselves, too, is with George Bush's political fortunes foundering very badly at this time, and I speak to you on July 5th of 1992, whether perhaps Bush would attempt to precipitate difficulties like that to help revive his political fortunes so he could appear to be the man on the white horse, the commander-in-chief, a la Desert Storm. Richard Nixon attempted to do that in 1972 when he felt his political fortunes were flagging as well. A chilling column advocating just exactly that appeared on the editorial page of the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, May 27th of 1992. This is a column by Lars, L-A-R-S, Eric, E-R-I-K, Nelson of the Chicago Tribune. It's headlined, this particular column, "We are at war in our cities. Send in the troops. Subheaded, armed men are murdering our citizens and each other at an unprecedented rate. We should, therefore, do what we did in Panama and Kuwait." Perhaps an unintentional rhyme there. Skipping down to the very last paragraph of this column, and it advocates using federal troops in a law enforcement capacity in our inner cities. Nelson writes, "Will we need the army? Then let's use the army. What else has it got to do? What threat do we face that is greater than walking down our own streets at night? This may seem like a draconian measure to liberals. I reply, it is a lot less draconian than the electric chair, and it will make the cities a whole lot safer." So we have a column appearing in apparently several major dailies, including the San Jose Mercury News, advocating the imposition of martial law, basically, in our inner cities. I'm going to reiterate something, actually reread something that I read during the conclusion of the program last week. I concluded the broadcast last week with an article from the London Observer of Sunday, June 7th of 1992, a story by Hugh O'Shaughnessy about Operation Gladio that's entitled Gladio, Europe's Best Kept Secret. It refers to the contingency plan to set up guerrilla forces in Europe in the event of a Soviet invasion to harass the Soviet army. Many of those contingency plans appear to have evolved into agent provocateur operations. In particular, in Italy, the Propaganda Due Lodge, a bogus Masonic lodge that in effect served as a crypto-fascist government virtually running Italy for quite some time, elements of P2 and elements of U.S. intelligence in cooperation with Italian fascists appear to have been involved not only in Operation Gladio, but in the apparently derivative strategy of tension. That was a program of terrorist incidents and assassinations conducted in Italy. They were conducted by the far right and elements of U.S. intelligence, or supported by elements of U.S. intelligence, and they were blamed on the left, and they were intended to drive the Italian political electorate to the right and discredit the very large and powerful Communist Party of Italy. We went into the strategy of tension in Radio Free America program number 19. But the goal of provocation and the goal of terrorist incidents, and we have to ask ourselves whether perhaps such things were going on in Italy, or in Italy, Freudian slip, in Los Angeles during the rioting, particularly in light of the curious selection of William Webster to look into the LAPD's behavior. We're going to reread, or I'm going to reread now, a section of this particular article. What we're going to be looking at is a quote from Vincenzo Vinciguerra, V-I-N-C-I-G-U-E-R-A, a convinced fascist, a self-described convinced fascist, who was involved in some of the strategy of tension terrorist incidents. The author, Hugh O'Shaughnessy, writes, again, London Observer 6792, Vincenzo Vinciguerra, a convinced fascist who was a member of the extremist Ordine Nuovo organization and had close links with Gladio, has testified to us of his personal involvement in such schemes. Now serving a long sentence in Parma prison for his part in the killing of three carabinieri in the village of Pettiano, P-E-T-E-A-N-O, he talked despite the Italian authorities' efforts to prevent access to him. Quote, "You had to attack civilians, the people, women, children, innocent people, unknown people, far removed from any political game," unquote, he said, again quoting. "The reason was quite simple. They were supposed to force these people, the Italian public, to turn to the state to ask for greater security. This is the political logic that lies behind all the massacres and the bombings which remain unpunished, because the state cannot convict itself or declare itself responsible for what happened." Continuing again, Vinciguerra recounted how the authorities covered the traces after the killing of the three carabinieri. Quote, "A whole mechanism came into action, that is, the carabinieri, the Minister of the Interior, the Customs Services, and the military and civilian intelligence services accepted the ideological reasoning behind the attack," unquote. "The commanders of the carabinieri foiled a thorough investigation of the Pettiano affair for years," he claims. Quote, "It was more convenient to cover it up than to turn on those who killed their comrades. All the members of the Red Brigades were known by the police, the Carabinieri, and the Intelligence Bureau, and no one made any attempt to stop them. So you see, quote, revolutionary warfare, unquote, should not be seen as being directed against Western democracy, but rather as the means of defense adopted by Western democracies and implemented cynically and indiscriminately," unquote. A very chilling, a very accurate statement of the intention behind political provocation, and I think we should ask ourselves just what might have been going on in Los Angeles in connection with the rioting down there in this particular regard. I would note, too, sort of jumping back to the theme that I was discussing throughout the first part of the program, another darling of the progressive community whose behavior I find very suspicious in a number of ways and who I think needs to be examined very carefully as a possible agent of some kind, and that is the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Again, this will appear to be heresy to many of you, political heresy. Perhaps some of you would advocate my burning again for being an intellectual heretic under the circumstances. But as I looked at, as we looked at, in connection with an addendum to Radio Free America program number 8 about the assassination of Martin Luther King, Jesse Jackson's behavior vis-a-vis that and a number of other things are worthy of scrutiny and asking some very serious questions. When Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, and again, James Earl Ray had nothing to do with it. He was a patsy, much like Lee Harvey Oswald. Again, the Radio Free America program number 8 talks about that. Jesse Jackson was seen to have been, basically, he gave a press conference. He was interviewed by reporters shortly after the assassination, and he had a bloody shirt on, and he claims to have held the he got the bloody shirt because he claims to have cradled the dying Dr. King's head. This despite the fact that many eyewitnesses, many of King's aides, claim that Jesse was nowhere near the body of the dying Dr. King. Many people have asked questions about that, and that has been the subject of considerable controversy vis-a-vis Jesse Jackson. On the Phil Donahue Show in June of 1988, Jesse Jackson admitted on national TV that he had been lying for 20 years about the assassination of Dr. King. His news story was that he did not actually cradle the doctor, dying Dr. King's head, but that there was so much blood in the on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel that some of it got on him. Well, it would have been a great deal of blood where Dr. King fell, also a little bit on the wall where the round tore through the base of King's skull, if Jesse Jackson was not, as he finally admitted, after 20 years, cradling the dying Dr. King's head. We have to ask ourselves how he got the blood on his shirt. Did he press his shirt against the floor? Did he press his shirt against the wall in back of Dr. King? Or just how did he come to get the blood on his shirt? Among the possibilities that we need to entertain, and this is certainly not a conclusion we can draw, but one of the questions that we have to ask is whether perhaps Jesse got that bloody shirt with foreknowledge of what was about to befall Dr. King. The assassination of Dr. King, like the assassination of President Kennedy, could be thought of as, in effect, a kind of coup d'etat. In this case, however, the state that was overthrown could be thought of as a state within a state, namely the black population of America, whose leader Dr. King unquestionably was. One of the basic truisms of the methodology of assassination is that if you're going to assassinate somebody for political reasons, a major figure, you want to replace that person with somebody who will do what the intended victim will not do. That's a basic methodology of coup d'etat, and the assassination of Dr. King could, in effect, have been thought of as a coup d'etat against a nation within a nation, namely black Americans. So one of the things we need to ask about Jesse is whether perhaps he was the selected tool, the selected replacement for Martin Luther King. Jesse's behavior, he finally admitted that he was lying in connection with the assassination of King. Jesse's behavior is very strange to me in a number of other ways. In 1988, many people, and I took a lot of flack for this when I suggested it, but many observers, including former Texas Congresswoman Barbara Jordan, a black congresswoman from Texas, she suggested that Jesse Jackson was deliberately undermining the candidacy of Michael Dukakis because he resented, that is to say, Jesse resented not being named as Dukakis's presidential, vice presidential candidate. That's a possibility that needs to be entertained. I would note that Jesse Jackson, shortly after George Bush won the presidency, maybe a week, 2 weeks afterward, had a press conference with George Bush after Bush ran that very racist campaign involving the Willie Horton ploy. And George Bush had a very interesting comment. He said, Jesse and I have worked together on a number of different policy considerations, and he challenged Jesse Jackson to deny it. Jesse did not deny it, and more significantly, Jesse Jackson and George Bush both agreed at that press conference that James Earl Ray should not be paroled. Well, James Earl Ray, as Jesse Jackson must certainly know, was innocent of the assassination of Martin Luther King, and whatever else one would make of Jesse's curious behavior vis-a-vis King's assassination, his advocating the withholding of James Earl Ray is certainly distasteful and, frankly, I think a little bit suspicious. Again, this is not a statement I'm making. It's a question I'm asking and one that I think needs to be asked because Jive Jesse is at it again in 92, making things rough for Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, of course, has been at loggerheads with Jesse Jackson, although now Jackson is attempting to mend fences, or so we're told. Clinton attended a function thrown by Jesse Jackson, one of whose attendees was a rap singer who uses the name Sister Soulja, S-O-U-L-J-A-H. My nickname for her is SS, the Good Soulja. Soulja made a very controversial statement at this gathering. She suggested that perhaps since black people murder black people, they might take a week and begin murdering white people, not police, as I erroneously said earlier. A listener phoned in to correct me. That particular statement, aside from being foolish from a political standpoint, because that could serve to justify the worst fears of white reactionaries and perhaps even serve to justify the imposition of an Operation Night Train or Rex 84 martial law plan in the inner cities, as Lars Nelson has advocated. It also serves to polarize the electorate. And I admire, frankly, Bill Clinton for opening fire on that particular comment by Sister Souljah. Jesse Jackson was deeply embittered by that and said that he didn't know if he could support Bill Clinton. Well, just think what the Republican attack dogs would have done with Bill Clinton's attendance at that conference and his failure to criticize Sister Souljah's comment. That would have been political death for Bill Clinton in many parts of the country, not just the South. Although he has drawn a lot of fire from the progressive political community on that, Jesse Jackson in particular, I think it showed a great deal of political acumen on the part of Bill Clinton, who's basically defending his flank. And again, just think back to the Willie Horton ploy. Just imagine what the Doberman Pinschers of the Republican Party would have done to Bill Clinton behind that one. They would have ripped him limb from limb. And just how the Bush political forces might have employed that particular comment by Sister Souljah against Bill Clinton came to light when George Bush began criticizing a rap singer named Ice-T for his cop. I'm not sure whether it's a single or an album called Cop Killer. I share that the distaste for those kinds of lyrics. This should not be interpreted as an indictment of rap music in general. But those kinds of lyrics, again, play right into the hands of the worst sorts of reactionaries in this country. And in the event of disturbances in L.A. or some of our other inner cities, whether naturally occurring or precipitated via agent provocateur activity, those sorts of lyrics serve to polarize the electorate and play right into the hands of the worst sorts of reactionaries and could ultimately serve as a partial pretext for the institution of martial law in this country. Again, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but with orders having been issued, stamped garden plot, it's a question we need to ask. I wonder also what Sister Souljah was doing making those kinds of comments at that function, whether she was just being stupid or whether perhaps, and this is a question I'm asking, not a statement I'm making, whether perhaps old Jesse was deliberately setting up Bill Clinton. I do not trust the man, and I think there's some very serious, that is to say, Jesse Jackson, I think there's some very serious questions to be asked about his behavior. For me personally, the fact that he would admit on national television that he'd been lying for 20 years about his behavior vis-a-vis King's assassination, that was all I personally would ever want to know. I wouldn't trust the man farther than he could throw me. But I think we need to ask some serious questions about Jesse Jackson, about Sister Souljah's comments, which had Clinton not countered them would have been political death for Bill Clinton. Again, just think back to the Willie Horton ploy and imagine what George Bush would have done with that. The last item that I'm going to present to you, though, is really sort of interesting in light of George Bush's criticisms of Ice-T. Again, I do not, there's no conclusion that we can draw from this, but it certainly is interesting, and it might have some sort of significance. I can't speak for Ice-T. Maybe he's a fool. Maybe he's more than a fool. Maybe he's being used as what the intelligence community refers to as a useful idiot. But in the political climate of 1992, to be making those kinds of statements, again, plays right into the hands of the worst sorts of reactionaries. Just look what George Bush did with that particular comment. However, I would note that Ice-T was in a movie recently. I did not see the movie. The movie was called Ricochet. But that movie was produced and financed by an organization called Silver Screen Partners. A researcher in Southern California named Scott Sawyer sent me the prospectus that was sent out by Silver Screen Partners. This in conjunction with the issuing of the stock, a $75 million stock offer for Silver Screen Partners. And again, it was Silver Screen Partners which underwrote the Ice-T film Ricochet. And there's an interesting item here in the listing of the management for Silver Screen Partners that financed, underwrote, basically was responsible for the production of the Ice-T film. One of the directors of Silver Screen Partners is none other than George W. Bush Jr., the son of the president. So an interesting situation. Perhaps George Bush should be a little more reluctant to criticize Ice-T in light of the fact that Ice-T's movie was financed by a company of which his son is a director. Perhaps no significance to it, but again, I wonder whether some of these people are just rhetorically clumsy, or whether some of them might actually be being used to deliberately inflame the political passions of the American people. Food for thought and grounds for further research. This concludes the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. Now, all of our archive broadcast shows are on permanent file with a tape duplication company. The name of that company is Archives on Audio. That's Archives on Audio. They're located at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. 415-346-1840. I should also mention that neither myself nor this station makes any money off of this announcement. This is FYI. This is Dave Emery thanking all the listeners for their contributions and encouraging them to tune in again to the next broadcast. Until then, take care.